glad morning when this life is over.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Bethann.
Good morning, and he did fly away.
Indeed. The great Ralph Stanley. Much missed.
And but there's a lot of good information, though, about him and a lot of his impact that he had over the years with younger generations. So glad at least that we have that, and glad we were able to start with that this morning on a Friday where we have a lot of things to talk about. Thanks very much for joining us for The Conversation this morning. Now, today, the 13th International Coral Reef Symposium comes to an end. As with all conferences, this one will likely finish with calls to action and a renewed commitment to the world's coral reefs. But after the conference high wears off, what are the actions we're most likely to see? Hugh Possingham is the head of the Nature Conservancy. He joins us now with his list of takeaways. Thanks very much for making time for us. You've been very busy this week.
Yes, good morning, Bethann. Yeah.
When you assess what this conference means going forward and who is there, there are sort of different populations of people who all came to this, different scientists, different levels. Those, as we've talked about before, policymakers and those scientists who are trying to feed into those policies but who are working in the lab. What was the split? How many people are deeply involved with lab work as opposed to those who are able to influence policy?
Yeah, a lot of the people there are scientists. Their primary reason for waking up in the morning is to go out onto the reef, to go into the lab and work out how it all works. What is the biochemistry of these systems? How are these fish populations functions? So their primary thing is basic science. That would be the majority, 60 or 70%. But then there's a lot of people at this meeting who are from the non-government sector, from the government sector, who are out there communicating with reef managers. Some are reef managers and trying to solve the problems to try and give us happy, healthy reefs into the future.
How well networked are all of these marine systems that we've seen, sort of, especially in the last year, 2 years, coming around the world?
Yeah, this conference is every 4 years, so that's not particularly a great way to network if it's only every 4 years, the big coral reef conference. However, organisations like the Nature Conservancy have a big reef resilience network, which is largely about education, and so they provide online materials, meetings, and ways of reef managers getting a deeper understanding of what is the science they need to manage reefs better, what actions can they take, and how can they form a community of people, a learning community of people. And so there are a lot of places where global experience from the Caribbean to the Great Barrier Reef to the Hawaiian Islands to the West Indian Ocean share their experiences. So it is really now a global family of reef managers and scientists.
According to the Pew Global Oceans Project, there were about 1 million square miles that were protected last year. As 2015 looked to be such a great year for protection, are we now sort of seeing a wave of protection that's moving into areas that we really hadn't seen before?
Definitely. The Convention on Biological Diversity targets asking the countries of the world to conserve 10% of their marine areas is marching ahead, and many countries like Australia fully intend to meet those targets by 2020. So we're seeing a massive expansion of marine protected areas, which is one part of the solution, of course. It's not the entire solution. And the other thing is that the work we do is really making sure those protected areas are in the right spot. It's not just a matter of grabbing your pencils and pens and drawing big lines on maps that make everybody happy. It's really about taking all this knowledge and science and trying to understanding of economics and people, because these reserves are just as much for the fishing community as for the tourism community as for the scientists. So bringing all these values together and coming up with reserves that are win-win for everybody.
You're talking about doing a bit of a cost-benefit analysis, it sounds.
Definitely. And the tools that are used to build marine protected areas, like the tool we've developed called Marksan, which does most of the rezoning of marine areas around the planet, has a lot of economics in it. So it's not just a matter of we're building protected areas for nature. It's a matter of saying, let's get a representative sample of the different kinds of habitat, make sure that this protected area system has a bit of every fish population in it, but also in a way that benefits the fishing community, recreational and commercial and artisanal fishing community, as much as possible. So it needs to be well connected. We want those fish in the reserves, which we know get bigger a big fish that's three times bigger produces about 10 times as many offspring. So these are like fish banks for the fishing industry. But we want to make sure that they then populate the places where the people can fish. So it's basically then a win-win situation for all parts of the community.
Protection is one side of it. Mitigation of the damage already done is another. How are you assessing that as you've had this big conference this week and talked a lot about places in the world that we know have seen serious reef degradation, including the Great Barrier Reef and the Caribbean and even Hanama Bay?
Yeah, the mix of coral bleaching, hurricanes, disease, and things like crown of thorn starfish, which occur in different areas, have degraded reefs quite severely at a global scale, and it's highly variable. And at times, to be honest, there's talk of people getting a bit depressed about the broad backward steps in terms of coral cover and coral reef health. However, people can do what they can do. And so marine reserves are one partial solution to protecting coral reefs, but also there's a lot of other simple things we can do. I think one of the big ones is reducing the sediments and the nutrients that are coming out of urban areas, developed areas and agricultural areas. They pose a severe threat and stress on marine ecosystems, and so managing sediments and soils is something that is also another win-win thing. Nobody wants to see soil go into the sea. It's not good. Nobody wants to see nutrients and toxic things go into the sea. It's not of any benefit to anybody. And so we really need to tighten up on that as much as possible.
When you say tighten up on that, that also goes back to the issue of enforcement. Mm. When you're not supposed to have runoff, when being able to manage that effectively. Mm. In Hawaii, that's been an issue too, as it has been in many places around the world. What do you tell people at this point when you say, you know, that's the one thing that you know that we can do? We might not be able to go in the way back machine and make the world the way it was before all this happened, but you're saying do what we can do, and to be able to do that, how do you engage people successfully when you have development issues?
That's right. Well, I think sometimes we have to legislate. Sometimes we have to tighten up the laws and have to have better enforcement. Sometimes we have to provide incentives. And in the rural community in Australia, there's going to be a lot of incentives for sugarcane growers, graziers to reduce the amount of, change the way they do their farming to reduce the nutrient inputs and stabilise the soils with riparian restoration. Riparian restoration is an easy thing to do that is, again, win-win. So there's things we can do that are beneficial to both the landowners and the reef.
Wish we had more time to talk. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Bethan.
Hugh Possingham is the new chief scientist for the Nature Conservancy.